Hello, this is Terry Malloy here to read The Week, the best of U.S. and international media. I'm reading again from the November 8th, 2019 edition. All you need to know about everything that matters. And we will continue on. And this article is from the best columns in Europe. European Union. Can human trafficking be stopped? It looks like mass murder, said The Guardian in the UK in an editorial. The bodies of 39 people, most thought to be Vietnamese, were found in a refrigerated container in southeastern England last week. In search of a better life, they had paid smugglers to transport them to the Belgian port of Zeebrugge, where they entered the airtight container and set off for the English port of Benfleet. 3 hours before the box was opened, passenger Pham Thai Tra Mai, 26, sent a harrowing text message to her mother in Vietnam. I'm sorry, Mom. My journey abroad hasn't succeeded, she wrote. I'm dying because I can't breathe. The Northern Irish driver of the container truck had been arrested and charged with manslaughter. But the trafficking ring surely extends further. These deaths come in spite of better detection methods and greater official alertness, or perhaps because of them. Improvements at ports such as Calais may have diverted people, smugglers, to less tightly monitored ports such as Zeebrugge. And dangerous refrigerated containers are used because they are more effectively sealed from scrutiny. How could this happen again? Asked Guillaume Gobert in La Croix in France. This isn't the first time Europe has seen trucks become mobile coffins. In 2000, 58 Chinese migrants were found dead in a trailer in the English port of Dover. In 2015, the decomposing bodies of 71 migrants, including 4 children, were discovered in a truck abandoned on an Austrian highway. These tragedies are made possible by the appalling cynicism of smugglers who don't hesitate to risk the death of their customers to maximize their profits. In Western Europe, politicians routinely say we must block the road to migrants, but few offer serious proposals to crack down on the traffickers who offer their disastrous services to those dreaming of a better existence. Without legal routes to get in, human trafficking will continue, said Victor Funk in the Frankfurter Rundschau in Germany. Over the past decade, Europe's leaders have thrown up border walls, restricted work visas, and tightened the process of gaining asylum, even though the fast-graying continent needs more young workers. Unsurprisingly, people smuggling services have flourished. EU interior ministers could cripple the trafficking industry by creating safer migration routes, a modern immigration policy, and asylum system that deserves the name. That's not going to happen anytime soon, said Heidi Avelin in Sweden. The EU officials got down on their knees for the despot in Ankara, trying to strike a deal with Turkey to keep Syrian refugees not here. All across the bloc, parties have sprung up whose sole policy idea is to stop immigration, such as the Sweden Democrats, France's National Rally, and Austria's Freedom Party. We'll do anything to keep the gate closed, and the desperate of this earth we'll do anything to reach our supposed lands of opportunity and safety. They will leap from bridges onto passing trucks, pack into rickety boats to cross the Mediterranean, and climb into airless containers. One of the best columns in Switzerland, What's in a Pastry's Name by Claudia Wirtz. The language police are coming for your cookies, said Claudia Wirtz. First, they cried racism over the Mohenkopf, or Moor's Head, a cream cake coated in chocolate. 2 years ago, activists demanded the decolonization of the patisserie, damning those who made and enjoyed Moor's Heads as violent racists. Apparently undeterred by their failure, they are now back and out to get the miette libé, that delicious finger-thick U-shaped pastry with a hazelnut filling, because its name means girls' legs. Sexism, they say. Objectification. One Basel-based bakery chain is now offering the traditional Bernese treat under the new name Lucky Charm, an apparent attempt to make consumers think of horseshoes rather than crotches. This obsessive judgment of virtue isn't merely tiresome. It's intensely divisive. A world in which everyone is always suspected of being racist or sexist doesn't lead to inclusivity. Instead, it creates a cynical, dogged, frustrated, and jealously controlling society that pits all against all, men against women, poor against rich, natives against immigrants, heterosexuals against homosexuals. The Swiss are a diverse people with multiple languages and ethnicities, living in federation, and we get on quite well. We ought to be able to enjoy a sweet treat without entering a moral battle zone. In the United Kingdom, Royalty, a Hard and Stupid Job, by David Arianovich in the Times. Prince Harry and his wife Meghan don't much like being Windsors, said David Arianovich, and who can blame them? Members of the British royal family have staggering wealth and privilege, yet their freedom of choice about their lives is almost as constrained as slaves. And we Windsors, ostensible subjects, drool for gossip about them, saying that because they live on the taxpayer's coin, we have the right to judge their every move and utterance. It's oppressive, as the couple told us last week in a TV documentary about their recent trip to Africa. Meghan was tearful about relentless criticism of her in the tabloids, while a protective Harry invoked his mother Diana, who died in a Paris car crash, fleeing paparazzi. "I will not be bullied into playing the game that killed my mother," he said. But it wasn't just the press that dogged her. Many in the public disliked her for her activism and resented or envied her glamorous lifestyle. The truth is, the only way for Harry and Meghan to escape our unconscious public sadism is to lecture the press. It is to renounce their royal status. And why not? Any disaster that required the sixth in line to assume the throne would be so substantial that half of us would probably be dead by then anyway. In Canada, a weakened Trudeau and a divided nation. In his second term in office, Julian Trudeau will face not only a divided House of Commons, but a dangerously fragmented country, said the Montreal Gazette in an editorial. The Canadian Prime Minister's Liberal Party is no longer in the majority following last week's general election, in which it won 157 seats in the 338-seat Commons, down 20 from the last vote in 2015. The Conservative Party took 121 seats, a gain of 26, and actually beat the Liberals in the popular vote, 34.4% to 33%. The leftist New Democratic Party won 21 seats, down 15, and the Green Party 3 seats, up 1. But the real story is the rise of separatism. The Bloc Quebecois made great gains, bringing to Ottawa 32 parliamentarians, 32 more than in 2015, who do not have the Canadian national interest at heart. And in the oil-rich western provinces of Alberta and Saskatchewan, where Trudeau's Liberals took not one seat, some politicians are muttering darkly about the prospect of a Western secession, or Wexit. Western Canadians are understandably furious with Trudeau, said Rex Murphy in the National Post. His over-dramatization of climate change is strangling their region's oil and gas industry. In his first term, he pushed through a law that smothers new pipeline projects with red tape, and he constantly flaunted his green credentials, posing for publicity shots with teen activist Greta Thunberg and TV scientist Bill Nye. The game is stacked against us in the sparsely populated West, said Ted Morton in the Calgary Herald. You need 170 seats to form a federal government, and Ontario and Quebec have combined 199 lawmakers. The three western provinces, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and British Columbia, together have only 90 seats, leaving the West vulnerable to fiscally predatory Liberal Party politics and policies. Indeed, since 2010, the government of Ottawa has pulled $15 billion a year out of Alberta to lavish mostly on Ontario and Quebec. No wonder separatist sentiment is rising. We have some of our science news. Health scare of the week is toxic metals in baby foods. Many common baby foods contain potentially harmful levels of arsenic, lead, and other toxic chemicals, reports NBCNews.com. The nonprofit group Healthy Babies Bright Futures, HBBF, tested 168 common baby foods from 61 brands. 94% contain lead, 73% arsenic, 75% cadmium, and 32% mercury. A quarter contained all four metals. One in five had over 10 times the lead level deemed excessive by public health bodies. The harmful effects of these metals is well established. Lead exposure can affect brain development in children. Arsenic is carcinogen. Even in the trace amounts found in food, these contaminants can alter the developing brain and erode a child's IQ, the authors write. The impacts add up with each meal or snack a baby eats. Among the highest risk foods identified by HBBF are fruit juices, rice-based products, sweet potatoes, and carrots. The group is pushing the Food and Drug Administration to set maximum safe limits for the metals. The world's noisiest bird. Ornithologists have identified the noisiest bird on the planet, with a call as loud as a pile driver. Native to the American rainforest, the male white bellbird can reach volumes of 125 decibels. At least 9 decibels louder than its noisiest rival. A typical human voice is only 60 decibels. The bellbird's call, a bizarre metallic-sounding squawk, forms part of a highly unusual mating ritual, researchers discovered. When a female lands nearby, the male sings the first note of his deafening song, facing directly away from his potential mate. Then sharply swivels his head around and yells the second note right in her face. The female knows it's coming because just before the turn, she flutters back a few feet. Whether such raucous behavior actually helps male white bellbirds secure a mate is not clear. We never saw copulation. We never saw what a really good male does, study co-author Jeffrey Protas from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst tells the New York Times. The ones we saw might have just been losers. A gene-eating word processor. Scientists have developed a new gene-editing tool that they say could one day be used to correct 89% of the genetic mutations that cause inherited diseases, such as cystic fibrosis and sickle cell anemia. The most popular existing gene editing approach, CRISPR-Cas9, uses molecular scissors to home in on a faulty piece of genetic code, then cuts both strands of the DNA, double helix, and splices in a new section of a code. Though cheap and fast, CRISPR-Cas9 often damages nearby code or inserts the new material in the wrong place. It's not a problem when researchers are working in the lab and can toss out the samples, reports TheGuardian.com. But it becomes an issue when scientists want to rewrite genes inside a person's body. The new technology, known as prime editing, cuts only one strand of the double helix, minimizing the risk of dangerous unintended changes. If CRISPR-Cas9 is like scissors, explained study leader David Liu from Harvard and MIT's Broad Institute, prime editors are like word processors. Liu and his colleagues have already used the new technology to make 175 DNA edits to human cells with incredible precision. In one experiment, they removed the four extra DNA letters in a gene that caused the nerve-destroying Tay-Sachs disease. In our making money section, housing. A long boom prices out new buyers. How long will the housing market keep humming along? Asked Paul LaMonica in CNN.com. Builder sentiment is at the highest level since February of 2018, according to the National Association of Home Builders. While data on building permits shows that starts for single-family homes are on the rise, low mortgage rates are helping to convince some renters, particularly younger millennials looking to start families, to take the plunge and buy homes. Investors have noticed the exchange-traded fund S&P Home Builders, that's XHB, a fund that includes shares of top builders and other companies with a lot of revenue tied to the housing market, is up a stunning 38% this year, while shares of Home Depot and Sherwin-Williams reached record highs last week. The one potentially bad omen, said Ryan December in the Wall Street Journal, remodeling activity, which has been growing at 5-7% annual clip, may be slowing. Renovation and maintenance spending is a good barometer of the housing market because sellers usually like to spruce up their houses before listing them. Years of price increases have created a shortage of affordable housing, said Prashant Gopal in Bloomberg Businessweek. Home prices in the U.S. are up 25% in 5 years, but new construction has been slow, as builders haven't stepped in with new housing. Some states, such as Oregon, have imposed a statewide cap on rent hikes, while Minneapolis became the first major U.S. city to eliminate single-family zoning. In parts of California, Washington, and even southern Florida, the average home price is now more than 6 times the median household income. Oregon is emerging as a testing ground for solving the affordable housing shortage, said Will Parker in the Wall Street Journal. In June, the state legislature passed a zoning law requiring cities of 25,000 people or more to allow 2, 3, and 4-unit residential buildings in neighborhoods of single-family homes. Oregon demonstrates the basic problems for the housing market around the country. Home prices there have increased at more than triple the pace of wage growth over the past decade. That can't go on forever. For the moment, though, things look good for the vast majority of housing market indicators, said Connor Sen in Bloomberg.com. August was the best month for building permits, a reliable leading indicator of housing starts, in more than a decade. Housing prices rising at a time when industry activity is plunging is unusual. The closest comparable period was 2001, when the technology bubble was going to burst. By contrast, tech is holding strong, and there's a good chance that the strong housing market could compensate for any slowdown from the trade wars. What the experts say? Tesla beats the shorts. Tesla's surprising earnings report cost its short sellers an estimated $1.4 billion in one day last week, said Thomas Frank in CNBC.com. The most heavily shorted stock in U.S. recorded its best day on Wall Street since 2013, popping almost 17% to around $300 per share after unexpectedly reporting a third-quarter profit. The surge wiped out almost 70% of short sellers' year-to-date profit after the stock had slid 23% since the start of 2019. Tesla CEO Elon Musk has over the years taken to Twitter to do battle against investors betting heavily against his company. Tesla reported earnings well beyond analysts' expectations and revealed to shareholders it is ahead of schedule, with a new factory in Shanghai, as well as its Model Y crossover vehicle. Rules for a 5-hour workday. A German consulting firm says its employees produce the same level of output for clients while working only 5 hours a day, said Eric Morath in the Wall Street Journal. The 16 employees start work at 8 a.m. and may leave at 1 p.m. But there are some rules. Small talk during work hours is discouraged. Phones must be kept in the backpacks. Email is to be checked only twice, and social media is entirely off limits. Meetings are scheduled to last no more than 15 minutes, but the firm's managing director says the company was profitable in 2018 with happier employees who deliver better work for clients than those working 40 hours interrupted with distractions. In 2015, a company in San Diego began a 5-hour workday that was an initial success, but soon felt employees' passion for the work started waning. The Raging Wildfire of Technical Debt by Alex Madrigal in The Atlantic. The California utility PG&E makes for an easy villain to blame for the wildfires raging across the state. But the problem is far, far deeper, said Alexis Madrigal. For decades, corporations, politicians, and voters have decided against doing routine maintenance on this nation's infrastructure. Instead, they've been borrowing against the future without putting that debt on the books. Programmers have a term for what accrues when you take the easy way out of coding problems. It's called technical debt, and it compounds. It can distort the true cost of decisions. PG&E officials have admitted that cutting off power to hundreds of thousands of people to keep its power lines from igniting fires will be a regular feature of fall life for a decade. It will also probably continue to raise rates for worse service. This is what runaway technical debt looks like. But California was not alone. Almost everywhere you look in the built environment, there are toxic technical debt bubbles growing and growing and growing. That's true of roadways, sewers, and wastewater plants. Levees, drinking water. We've been kicking the can down the road for decade after decade, and climate change is now calling in the debt. Big tech is setting the table for a major breakup. The year 2020 is poised to become the year of the great antitrust reawakening, said Joe Nocera in Bloomberg Businessweek. The last time antitrust was dominant theme during a presidential election year was 1912. For the first time in decades, a genuine rethinking of the way antitrust laws are enforced appears to be taking place, and the focus is squarely on the big four companies, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, and Google. Cutting their power is a big part of the Democratic agenda, but Republicans, too, come with a long list of complaints. Well, I think that's it for this week. This is Terry Malloy wishing you all a great week ahead. I'll be back next Sunday to read the week.